This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are, live with all your faults. I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so why don't you find it?
4 minutes after 8 on a Tuesday, and if it's Tuesday, Alex Holling is not supposed to be on, but he's on today.
So, I had to throw a wrench in the works, man.
Exactly. Well, you didn't really. Your mother did. So we're always respectful of mom. So
we'll call it 50-50 because she's looking for a place. I'm moving at the end of this week, too. So, like, I spent the first half of the day helping her look at places, spent the second half of the day packing my office. It was my birthday, so, you know, that's what us old guys do on our birthdays now, right?
Wow.
Is you spend the whole day working on stuff that you should have. That you should get done on the weekend.
You're moderately busy then. So wait a minute, you're moving out of the arson event?
I am. My landlord sold the house.
Oh.
So as much as I would prefer to stay deep in the woods, just based on the timeline, we're actually going to move into a neighborhood.
Yeah.
I'm really not stoked. I'm not going to lie. This new house is going to be great for my daughter. The neighborhood's great for my wife and daughter. I may not have gotten anything that I wanted out of this move.
Get used to it.
Right, exactly.
Get used to it. Look, just get us the paycheck, okay, and then live out the string. That's what you're here for.
Exactly. Okay? You know, like, I mean, this new neighborhood, the new house is way bigger than the one we live in now, which is good because this is a two-person house, you know. But it's like you can – the neighbors' houses are so close to the house. Maybe this is normal now, and I'm just a crazy woods person. But I don't think I should be able to look into your house from my house. You know?
Yeah.
So I'm going to invest heavily in curtains.
Don't be that. Hey, don't be that weirdo dude that moves in the neighborhood and starts acting all kooky, okay? Try to just...
Unavoidable.
Try to just be like, hey, Larry, what's going on? Good to see you. Go Dogs. Right?
Does this crazy asshole ever leave his house? No,
yeah.
I don't. I sit in my office.
Be that guy. Be just another neighbor. Don't be that dude. So, okay, so give us a... I want to talk to you about your mom moving in now. Everybody loves their mom, but not everybody needs their mom close to them. So give me your thoughts on your mom moving near you, and then we'll begin the lightning round.
I believe it or not, I am absolutely excited for one terrible self-serving reason. I love my mom. I'm glad to have my mom around. But, you know, I have a babysitter now.
Yeah, no kidding.
How awesome is that?
And she's fired up for it, too. And she'll actually take care of your kid, and she knows what she's doing, right?
I mean, I hope so. That's one thing we keep talking about. But she's like, you turned out fine. And I'm like, Mom, I didn't turn out fine. Let's be clear here.
But in all the major areas, right? You've got a job. You're
That's
married.
True.
You have a kid.
That's true.
You fought through it. So, I mean, look, between the left and right lateral limit of the range, your mom, she did okay.
My mom did an amazing job. My mom's an awesome, awesome lady. However, the things that were passable for you to let your child do in the 80s just really don't fly nowadays, you know? I remember as a kid, I mean, this is actually something I would lament about, but as a kid, you know, 3-4 years old playing outside without supervision was not that weird. You know, my mom could see me through the window. Everything's fine. You don't assume every passerby is going to come and kidnap your child. Nowadays, I mean, you have a 10-year-old playing outside, someone will call the police on you.
Yeah.
You know, so it's – my daughter's growing up in a very different world, I think, than I did.
Right.
But I tell you what, there's nobody out there that's better suited to take care of my kid than my mom, other than maybe my wife. But the most important thing for me is just the fact that I might get to see a movie this year.
Whoa, yeah.
Pretty excited.
If there's any good ones. But you won't even care if it's good. You'll just be, hey, I got to go to the movie.
Yeah, I was going to go outside. Like the other day, you know, I went out for my run, and my wife needed to go to the store, and my mom happened to be at the house visiting and was like, oh, you guys can go ahead. You know, go ahead and go for your run, and she can go to the store, and I'll stay here with Reagan. And that it actually hadn't crossed my mind until that moment that there's another adult person here that I could pass my kid off to.
Yeah, and you only got, what, about 16 more years of that stuff to go. So good for you.
Right.
Good for you. Congratulations. All right, well, Ben, wow, there's some big life changes. Moving in the neighborhood, mom coming down. You know, but I think that is all going to enhance your quality of life. Your wife's going to be happier. Your daughter's, you know, not going to be that girl who lives in the woods, right? She's not going to be that girl. So that's...
I guess that's a good thing. You know, it really is. Yes. And the new house has got so much more space. I'm going to be able to, for instance, be on All Marine Radio without you guys hearing Blippi playing in the background and stuff like that. That'll be a nice change of pace. I'm looking forward to that part at least.
Nice. All right, before we get to lightning, I want to ask you a political question.
Okay, hit me.
The governor of Virginia, can you write off, like, 20 years after the Civil Rights Movement kind of hit its apex in the late 60s, if you're in the 80s, like, making jokes in Ku Klux Klan costumes and doing things like that, is that something you can write off as, come on, it was a joke? Can you?
Now, this is a difficult question because there's layers to it. The first thing...
Hold on. There's layers to the shit player, tiramisu. That's a Macklemore lyric. I love
it. Dude,
that.
I'm actually a pretty big Macklemore fan.
You recognize it. I'm representing Macklemore.
Absolutely.
And if you don't know what tiramisu is, it's a layered dessert, right, with kind of these ladyfinger things and cream cheese and liqueur in it. Yeah, so when Macklemore sings, there's layers to the shit player, tiramisu. If you don't have culinary game, then you don't know what he's talking about. But I do. Boom.
it's a digression, but I found my way to Macklemore because of my daughter. Because most of his music videos, you can actually play in front of a child without her being exposed to, like, anyone's labia or horrible violence.
Did you say labia? I think it was a first on All Marine Radio.
That's the first time anyone's ever said
it. Yeah, I don't think we've ever gone there before.
Watch any Nicki Minaj or Miley Cyrus music video with your one-year-old daughter, and you'll ask yourself some hard questions about what parts of the anatomy you're allowed to show on MTV.
Why would I watch either one of those artists? I know they're really cool, I mean, in pop culture, but I didn't think you were a pop culture guy.
I'm not, but, you know, my daughter loves music and music videos, so it's forced me to engage. I can only show her so many, you know, the Dead South and old Tenacious D music videos before my wife gets mad.
I'm with you.
But Macklemore's on the list. But big digression. Anyway, the one of the biggest problems that we need to engage with as a society at this point is the understanding that all of us, at some point, have been an idiot. Right. We've all done something that we're not proud of. We've all done something that we're even ashamed of, or that we know in hindsight was the wrong thing to do, and it was a bad decision. Now, I don't know the governor of Virginia personally. I don't know that in his heart he feels like he made a bad call. You know what I mean? Or he might genuinely be like, what's the big deal, you guys? But I have to play this song and dance in the press.
Right.
And the way he feels about it personally is going to say a lot about his character, and that should inform how we feel about him as a governor. But ultimately, at the end of the day, in our current political climate, it doesn't matter, man. Our parties are so engaged in trench warfare that what's important here is that one side is able to use this to attack the other side, using the exact same ammunition that the other side used to attack them in the first place. You know, conservatives and liberals have both had a lot of luck over the past year drudging up the embarrassing pasts of prominent voices on either side of the political party. You know, on the right extreme, you've got Alex Jones, you know, all of his tweets, you know, being brought back to haunt him. On the left side, you're even seeing guys like James Gunn losing movie contracts to film movies because of tweets that he sent out 6 years ago. We've gotten really good at digging up our past and using it against one another.
Well, okay, and I absolutely agree with you. And another example is the guy from Oklahoma, the quarterback who won the Heisman Trophy, had to answer questions about a tweet that he called a friend of his a queer when he was 15 or 16. And,
exactly.
Right?
You know?
And so to me, okay, and I get all that. But 20 years or so after the Civil Rights Movement, between 15 and 20 years after the Civil Rights Movement hit its apex in this country, if you're still doing Ku Klux Klan jokes, you might be stupid. And
I'm inclined to agree.
And I don't know if I can pull you back from that one. Like, I can pull you back from garden variety stupidity that I think that falls under the bell curve. The Ku Klux Klan is not that.
It's not that.
Right.
Now, this is what I mean about this being complicated, is because I have to approach topics like this from two perspectives. The first one being my personal opinion. My personal opinion is this guy's an asshole.
Right.
The problem is that my personal opinion really doesn't have any bearing on how things actually play out. Even if hundreds of millions of us in the United States share the same personal opinion, a lot of times that doesn't matter so much as the way that you can sell this to a crowd, the way that you're going to see this narrative getting shaped in the media and on social media in the days to come. The problem here is that you cannot stand in a defensible position saying, we're going to come after the opposition when they demonstrate this type of behavior, if you're willing to defend it among your own, right? So when you see, if you're a Democrat and you see a Democrat doing dumb shit, you can't defend that if you hope to attack that same dumb shit when you see it exhibited by Republicans.
Come on.
Now, we are really good at doing it anyway.
Have you seen the Washington Post get after the governor of Virginia yet? No. And we're not talking about allegations like the Brett Kavanaugh thing when they went hysterical.
Absolutely.
When they went hysterical. So why would you be so naive as to say that the great newspapers, the great media outlets, which have built great reputations on quote unquote reporting, which owes a fidelity to the truth, why would you think they would live up to that?
No, I don't. That's exactly the problem. What I think is what we're going to see is the story being shaped into something by people on both sides of the fence. And you're going to see it from, you're going to see it exacerbated by biased outlets. You're going to see it really, really exacerbated on social media, particularly on platforms like Twitter, where people, yeah. I'm convinced that Twitter is just like that, the slime river from underneath the city in Ghostbusters 2. It's just like you go into Twitter just to look for fights, you know? So you're going to see this narrative shape based not on what actually happened, but based on good defensive and offensive tactics. You know, the debate is going to shape this, not the actual event, as is the case with most things. So what we're going to see genuinely is you're going to see people defending this guy and you're going to see people attacking this guy. But the defense and the attacks will be on the merits of the party. It'll be on the merits of, you know, precedents that we've set in the past with other politicians. We're already doing the, well, you saw this guy, but what about this guy? We're already framing these arguments in our head. This is what's going to happen. It's not going to be about this guy or what he did. It's going to be about how you can hurt his party if you're on the opposition. And if you're on his side, you're going to defend him because it's about defending your party instead of about doing the right thing. This is, in my opinion, indicative of the problem with our American politics across the board.
Is there any hope for the country when the truth isn't significant? When it's not significant to the Washington Post, is there any problem with that? Because they are a huge part of our American democracy. They are, what do they call the press? The Fifth Estate? You know, or
now,
the French call them that?
This
or
is where I'm going to piss some people off.
The press
is at fault, but they share this fault with the American people. The reason why you're seeing such biased journalism out there is because bias sells so much better than objectivity.
I knew you were going to say that.
I cannot tell you how often I get accused of having a bias just because I'm reporting something people don't like.
Other than by the Russians who hate you?
Other than by the Russians. On any given week, you know, especially on Twitter, for instance, I'll tweet something that's, because I follow Donald Trump and I follow AOC for very similar reasons, because they use the exact same tactics, the exact same mannerisms. They are the same person on different sides of the aisle. You know, so I will regularly retweet one or the other and be like, this is actually true, or this is insane.
Right.
You know? But without fail, if I share one, I will be attacked by people accusing me of just going after that party or that guy because they didn't bother. I mean, I've published almost 3,000 pieces of writing over my career. If you want to know my political stances, you can find it. You know, but a good example is I wrote a story, which we'll probably talk about in the lightning round last week, called America's Tremendous Military Might Doesn't Matter Like You Think It Does. And the intent of the piece was trying to point out that when we compare the American military to foreign militaries, America's military absolutely stands head and shoulders above everybody else. But we don't consider the fact that it would be all but impossible for us to amass all of America's military might into one conflict. We really can't do that. And if we were to do it, it would create such far-reaching security implications in the rest of the world that it would throw the globe in turmoil if we were to try to. Ooh. So when we say, yeah, America's military, we outspend the Chinese by 8 times, that's in part because every soldier costs us significantly more. But it's also in part because we're maintaining a global presence, and we can't bring that global presence to bear in a regional conflict without significant sacrifices. But if you read the headline said, America's massive or tremendous military might doesn't matter like you think it does. If you read the comments on that piece, nobody read it. They just said that I'm a communist and a libtard, and I'm attacking America's military. You know, our veterans deserve better.
Exactly. You know?
And if you click on the story, it's like America's great. We have the best military in the world, but you need to be realistic about the ways in which we can use it. Nobody bothered to read it. They just wanted to attack someone that they perceive to be on the other side of the fence. This is how we frame our conversations today. It's got nothing to do with what this governor did, no matter how bad it is. It's got nothing to do with how offensive the photo is, because if you're on his team, you're going to defend it. And if you're not on his team, you're going to attack it. Those truths are evident prior to or above whatever it is that's actually in the photo or whatever he did. It's an unfortunate truth right now, but the only way that things like this get better is for people to get sick of it. If you stop buying it, if you stop putting the money into the newspaper machine when the headline is about this crap, if you stop clicking on the stories that elicit rage because you're feeding your need for rage, you'll start seeing these things become less prominent. But
okay,
right now,
so
it's the most marketable thing we've got.
When I amass the capital and begin my own version of CNN, which is going to be called Credible News Network, all right?
You have to be careful with that, man, because most of the independent outlets that use words like credible in the title
are
the least credible.
All right, but that's why this is going to be a complete epiphany. You're going to be the editor of the site.
I like it. I'm in.
We're going to hire disabled veterans that are interested in journalism, and we're going to build this Drudge Report kind of thing, right? But we're only going to have like people we know to be honest writers. They're the only people that are going to appear on this page. So if you want truth, you know where to go. And we're going to reshape journalism. What do you think?
I think it's a great idea. I think that that's the future of journalism, is people like you building these outlets and then it finding an audience among people who are increasingly frustrated with – I mean, I can't for the life of me at this point really understand anybody being 100% plugged in to the news that they're seeing each day and really genuinely feeling as though the Republican Party or the Democratic Party 100% unequivocally represents their views. You know, I can't imagine someone feeling as though they're really being fairly represented.
Yeah.
When the debates that you see on the national level, more often than not, don't have anything to do with our daily lives. They're much more to do with your ability to garner headlines.
Yeah.
You know?
It's the game of charades they play.
It really is.
Okay, but hold on.
You see very little change ever actually occurring, but you see a lot of fire and bluster.
We have to do the lightning round, otherwise you'll filibuster this into the next hour. So
I think that's one day I should start a podcast on the Old Marine Radio Network called The Filibuster.
The Filibuster. And you've said, this is, I don't know how exactly you said it, but you said, okay, this is a sidebar. This is going down a rabbit hole. You said that twice, and that's never a good sign for when you're on. Okay.
Never a good sign, yeah.
The United States has officially withdrawn from the bilateral INF treaty with Russia. First of all, tell us why, and then the implications for future treaties with Russia and China.
This is a great example of one of those things that get me in trouble with liberals, because Trump's right. You know, Trump's not always wrong, guys.
Right.
He's, you know, just because the guy says something doesn't mean it's a bad idea.
Yeah, I know. Just because we're all cringing, if you're a conservative, we're all cringing you know, at what he's going to say tonight, because speech making is not really.
Yeah, I am concerned as well.
And so even if you're a conservative and say, no, no, what he's done with NATO, we had to do that with NATO. Okay. The economic confrontation with China, it's been long overdue. They need to come and have to act like a, first of all, we have to stop giving China breaks because they're not a full-fledged member of the WTO. They're still in this kind of developing nation status. That's bullshit. But we need that. So I agree with you. But God Almighty, some of the stupid shit he does. So anyway, I'm with you.
Conservative guy, the problem I have with Donald Trump is usually how poorly he sells things that I think are a good idea. Right. You know, for instance. So the INF Treaty, let's talk about what it was or what it was supposed to be in the first place. The INF Treaty is really – it's a treaty meant to block our and Russia's ability to produce cruise and ballistic missiles with ranges between 500 and 1,500 kilometers. What does that actually mean? These are short and medium-range missiles that you could feasibly mount nuclear warheads on and then feasibly place in Europe and then feasibly have a terrible nuclear war in Europe because we're using these short-range nuclear missiles. Those are the talking points you will get from every outlet that really just wants to jump down Trump's throat. So they're saying Putin's going to build nuclear weapons. Putin's new nukes are in development now because of this treaty. Trump's new nukes. I don't remember which MSM outlet I saw call it Trump's new nuclear weapon, which are these cruise missiles that we've had in development since, well, before Obama was in office. You know, like – the way that they're trying to frame this is this idea that Donald Trump is trying to increase the number of nuclear weapons in Europe, which has nothing to do with these circumstances whatsoever. It is true that the INF Treaty would prevent the development and the placing of short and intermediate range nuclear or conventional tipped missiles on the European continent. But what people are losing sight of is what prevents nuclear war is not us keeping you from having short range nukes. That isn't even a part of the situation. Mutually assured destruction is and has been our means of defense against nuclear war since the onset of the nuclear era. As soon as the Soviets had nukes of their own, and we weren't the only guys in town with the big gun anymore, the fact that we had them pointed at each other is what keeps us from firing. You can put all the short-range nuclear weapons on the European continent that you want. One nuclear strike still leads to the end of the world. This is the same argument I have when people are concerned about Russia's 200-megaton doomsday submarine. Guess what? A really powerful nuke or a not-that-powerful nuke have the exact same effect on global stability, which is eliminates it. I'm not worried about how big your nuke is, and I'm not really worried about how small it is, nor am I that concerned about where you could feasibly position it, because as soon as you launch your first one, the world's over.
Yeah.
You know? So, if we don't have to worry about Russia putting nukes in Europe, like the Washington Post and CNN really want you to be worried about, what does the INF really do? So Russia, as we've been saying since 2008, has been building a weapon that violates the INF treaty. It's a cruise missile that's got a range that falls within that 500 to 1,500 kilometer range. It could feasibly have a nuclear tip. So Russia, a couple weeks ago, because we said, listen, we know you're doing it. We've been talking to you about it since 08. We're done. We're not going to keep abiding by this INF treaty that prevents us from building comparable weapons if you're not going to abide by it yourself. So Russia made this press conference where they showed the tube one of these missiles would belong in, and they went, see? That's totally – everything's fine. Look at this tube. It's a great tube. And surprise, 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 it didn't convince the Trump administration, you know?
Damn
so
it.
We're backing out of the INF Treaty. Now, this is what we get as a result of that. The INF Treaty prevented only the United States and Russia from developing these weapons. Russia's not the actual threat on the horizon we need to be worried about. Russia's economy couldn't sustain a war with the United States, let alone with the U.S. and NATO. The country we need to be worried about from a threat standpoint is China. China, it's important to note, is not a signatory member of this treaty. That means that China has been building these missiles that violate this treaty throughout, all along. All of these hypersonic anti-ship missiles we're so concerned about coming out of China all violate the INF treaty, were they a member. China's got the largest, arguably, there's some contention here, arguably the largest stockpile of ballistic and cruise missiles anywhere on the planet. 95% of them, according to experts, are likely missiles that would violate the INF treaty were they a part of it. The United States, as you would suspect, has none. We're developing one now. This is a problem. This creates a capability gap in the Pacific where we have actual concerns to our nation's interests to worry about. A good example would be we could make missiles that would violate the INF Treaty that we could actually place on land in allied territory throughout the Pacific in places like Japan. These missiles would not only increase the target, the targets that China would need to worry about, China would need to engage more offensive targets to prevent us from launching missile strikes on their mainland, but it would also force the Chinese to adopt more of a defensive posture when it comes to their missile apparatus. China's got a missile corps. It is a branch of their armed forces devoted to operating missiles and rockets. They would need to focus on defending against our land-based missiles if we had any. Right now, we don't have a means to go to war with China. We can't get our carriers close enough to them, assuming their targeting apparatus is mature enough, to launch airstrikes. So the only way we could go to war with China is if we use like B-2 Spirits from the U.S. to fly bombing raids on their anti-ship missile emplacements first, and then bring our carriers in, hopefully soon thereafter, keep them moving at 30 knots, keep them zigzagging in hopes of trying to defend against these missiles, and then launching increased sorties. It's not going to work. We've got a lot of programs in development. We've got the Mark 25 Stingray, which is a drone refueler from carriers. We've got the Block 3 Hornet upgrades. We're working to offset this gap. But right now, we don't have a means to. These missiles could help offset that gap. The best thing we could do is back out of this treaty. Russia's not abiding by it. So really, all it's doing is tying our hands and preventing us from mounting a really legitimate defense against China in the Pacific.
Got it. All right. So even though we back out of it with Russia, Russia's probably not the object because we know they're blustering, lying bozos.
Yeah, and they're doing it anyway. So right. if the three countries in the world,
so we're self-deluding by staying and by saying, yeah, this is actually a treaty. Really? It's not because they're violating.
Absolutely. You know, it's the equivalent of like when you played video games with your brother as a kid. And you would put the handicap on his character. Russia's got the handicap. America's the only country not building these missiles.
Right.
You know? So why would we let Russia tie our hands when they're not abiding by the treaty themselves?
Okay, so it's a good thing we get out. And what will this do, you, in your opinion, will this spawn future talks, trilateral talks between Russia, China, and the United States on these weapons? You think that's
no,
in the
I don't think it will. And the reason why is because it wouldn't benefit China or Russia. Russia and China are both in the position right now where they're seen globally as
well. I disagree because Russia doesn't have the economy to participate in an arms race. And that,
of course not. Absolutely right? not.
So they're but bankrupted.
Russia's not in the market of fielding actually operational weapons platforms.
They're just faking it.
Russia's in the business of putting on an amazing marketing campaign to try to sell, you know, the people on America's naughty list that we won't sell aircraft to, we won't sell weapons systems to. They want to be an arms supplier. They're not really interested in actually going to war. They need to act tough and talk the tough talk. So that these other nations go, we got to get some of those Russian S-400s, because I bet you those will shoot down an F-35. I hate to break it to you guys, it probably wouldn't. But Russia's really good at trying to sell that idea. And that's what a huge portion of Russia's forward-facing strategy is looking like the aggressor, is being the bully, is seeming intimidating and aggressive, because that makes you think of them as a militarily powerful nation with weapons platforms that are worthy of purchase. They're not really, and Russia isn't really. But one thing that Russia's very, very good at, as we've seen since the 2016 election and well before, they're very good at branding.
They are good at branding. So let me ask you this. What happens when the brander-in-chief, who's a bit of a historical anomaly, what happens when the brander-in-chief goes away? Do they suffer irreparable harm because the next person that follows him is not going to have the same kind of swag that Vlad Putin has?
It's a real possibility. You know, it's entirely possible. I would argue, I'd contend.
Because Gorbachev didn't, Yeltsin didn't, nobody else has
now,
had.
Russia's got a lot of experience with the way that they go about hybrid warfare, which is kind of this the combination of using near-conflict combat operations and information operations to kind of paint a picture of Russia the world over,
right?
Their apparatus is mature.
Right.
I don't think that you can credit Putin with the day-to-day operations of that apparatus at this point. Early on, I think you can, you know, but at this point, The system's working. The problem is whether or not, you know, it's just like the CEO of a company can, you know, can totally ruin a company's perceptions based on just, you know, coming out and saying something crazy in the press. A new Russian president could do the same thing. He could really, really hurt Russia's standing as a military leader, Russia's standing as someone with a seat at the table.
I think
conversely, he could do a great job. Who knows?
I don't think anybody's in Putin's class. Putin, by virtue of his training and the way he came through the whole Soviet Union transition into Mother Russia, to me is a historical anomaly. So
it's a tough sell, but it is important to remember that even if the next guy sucks, that doesn't.
There's the buzzer. What happened?
There's the buzzer.
All right, next subject: comparing military strength numbers and why we're not doing it right. Explain.
This is what I was talking about earlier. So,
I love the buzzer. That was awesome.
That was good. That works well. Yeah. So basically, we've already discussed this pretty much at length. The idea that the United States overspends on its military, it's an easy argument to make, but it's not technically that accurate. There's a lot of things that come into play that make America's massive military footprint so expensive, but also so important to us as the United States of America. One of them being the fact that it costs so much more money per soldier, per service member, to field the U.S. military. So when you look at a country like Russia or China, China's standing military is larger than the United States, but costs significantly less to maintain.
Yeah.
They pay their soldiers less. They give them fewer benefits. The health care after the fact is less. The VA may suck here in the United States, but it sure beats nothing. And that's what a lot of veterans get for these other nations. So, I mean, you could easily make the argument that it costs $3 for every U.S. soldier to the $1 it might cost a Chinese soldier just to have them on the payroll. You know, when we're talking about training, you can look at aircraft training as a great one. On average, American pilots have 2 or 3 times as much seat time than Chinese or Russian pilots. That's a budgetary issue. You could put an American in an F-15 and a Chinese pilot in a J-20, which is a more advanced aircraft. I'd take the American pilot in the F-15 only because that guy in the J-20 has only flown that friggin' airplane 3 times. You know? It costs us a ton of money to even maintain the exact same military footprint as these other nations just because we treat our service members well and we ensure that they've got the training they need to win in a war, as opposed to just being able to put out press releases that show how good our military is.
So your point is that the other forces are hollow forces?
They're not necessarily hollow, but they're certainly not as well equipped or as well trained.
Kind of.
And that's one large facet of it. Another large facet of it is that the United States, for instance, we have coastline on both the Atlantic and the Pacific, right?
Yes.
That means that we need to be able to defend both of those oceans well. And I don't mean defend our shoreline. I don't mean literal combat.
Are you talking about coastal batteries? Like,
no, you need to be able to head those threats off well in advance of them reaching our actual coastline, especially in the era of ballistic missile submarines, let alone things like the Status 6, that nuclear doomsday sub. Right. You need to be able to prevent means of force projection from getting to within range of U.S. shores.
Got it.
That means that we've got to maintain a sizable fleet in both the Atlantic and the Pacific. Then you talk about global trade.
Right.
The U.S. is the most powerful economy on the planet. China's in competition. The U.S. trade is built on global trade, right? Our economy is inextricably interwoven with the global economy at this point. Without American military presence around the world, a lot of these shipping lanes destabilize. You know, you hear about piracy in the Horn of Africa all the time. The reason why you hear about it is because it's unusual for there to be a part of the world where you've got to worry about pirates.
Arg.
There's a reason for that, and it's us. I mean, other nations certainly play a part. But the United States' giant navy absolutely plays a role in keeping shipping lanes stable. This is the root of all the tension in the South China Sea. China wants to declare sovereignty over the South China Sea, where a third of all global commerce is shipped over. If China owns it, they get to have a piece of a third of all global commerce, aside from the natural resources held within. This is why we're worried about the South China Sea, is because we maintain the stability of the global economy through the threat of military force in a lot of places. So if we wanted to go to war with China, let's say, and we wanted to take all 11 of America's carriers, which I hear people talk about all the time. So what if China can sink one carrier? We'll send 10 more. Let's say we do. Let's say we also send all, like, 19 amphibious assault ships that we've got, you know, which are basically carriers, too. Let's say we send a whole 270-ship navy to China. China's got 650 ships in the Pacific right now. We could send our entire navy over there and still be outnumbered 2-1. Doesn't mean they win, but we got a real fight on our hands, you know? And that's with our entire navy present. If we could send 2 or 3 carrier strike groups, which is traditionally how we go about fighting these wars, we would be hopelessly outnumbered. Still doesn't mean we lose, but we'd have a real fight on our hands. China's military is nowhere near as technologically advanced. It does boast larger numbers, but they're poorly trained. I'm not contending that the Chinese military could defeat the breadth of the American military.
Right.
I do contend, however, that their military is big enough and equipped well enough to be a real problem for the forces we could get to the region. And that's something that people forget about when they say, we should just go to war with North Korea. I miss the days when we just killed the bad guys. Right. Those days never existed. We've always tried to avoid war because war always leads to a bunch of people dying and spending a bunch of money.
Which is, it's a good thing to avoid. And,
absolutely.
And we're obviously watching that play out.
But, you know, it's been so long since we fought a near-peer war that I think a lot of Americans don't have any sense of
what...
Oh,
no, no. Like. Near-peer, which we'd mobilize the country, and you would worry about, are they going to invade the United States? This thing is going south. It's not going. You know, and that's
can you imagine what Americans would act like if there was an actual threat of invasion of the United States?
No.
Can you... I mean, the reason why Americans don't care is that we're still at war and multiple fronts is because it has no repercussions in their lives. We're fighting these wars over in the Middle East. You're right. That was a digression.
China and Russia are far behind us in stealth, but the media keeps trying to fool us into thinking otherwise. I like this headline, man. I'll click on it. What's going on?
Well, so Russia's got a Su-57, a fifth-generation fighters. Let's start with a quick explanation of what that is. A fifth-generation fighter is what our F-22 and F-35s are. It's an aircraft that was built with stealth intrinsically as a part of its design. As opposed to, you know, like the Block 3 Super Hornets, we're going to put radar-absorbent coating on them to increase their stealth profile, but it's not a stealth aircraft, right?
An
F-22 and F-35 is a stealth aircraft. It also is supposed to have super cruise capabilities. In other words, it can maintain supersonic speeds without its afterburners. And most importantly, some would contend, it's got to be able to network varied targeting apparatuses. It's got to be able to draw data from drones, from surface vessels, from land-based equipment, and kind of put it all together into one stream consciousness of data. Currently, the only real fifth-generation fighters in the world are the F-22 and the F-35. You see lots of headlines about Russia's stealth fighter, the Su-57, and about China's J-20 stealth fighter that China claims is far superior to the F-35.
Of course they do.
These aircraft are not, right now, combat feasible. According to China and Russia, they're operational. But let's start with the Su-57. The Su-57, right now, they have one, count them one, operational Su-57 that has super cruise capabilities, is theoretically stealth, and theoretically has networking capabilities. They have a single aircraft.
Nice.
You would never know that based on the headlines about Russia's stealth fighter.
Yes.
I mean, last week, I think Business Insider ran a story about how we painted one of our aggressor F-16s with the same paint scheme as the Su-57, and that's going to give us a huge advantage in an air war. It's bullshit. It's make-believe.
Right.
We're pretending the Su-57 is a threat.
When they're dogfighting, it's going to help us.
Yeah, when we dogfight the one Su-57 that they're going to fly over here, it's bullshit.
Yeah.
So China's J-20, kind of a similar, but the Su-57, even worse, they've pushed production back on it to 2023 is when they think they'll start getting delivery of their first 13.
Nice. Rome wasn't built in a day. Quit being a jackass.
And these 13 are all going to be built with older engines that don't maintain super cruise capabilities, so their flight ranges will be really hindered. They're still fourth-gen fighters, And none of them are stealth, just because Russia lacks the production capability to create things with that tight a tolerance to actually prevent a radar return. So then you look at China's J-20, which is based on the F-22, on stolen plans for the F-22. So you'd think would be a very capable stealth fighter. They added these front canards to the J-20, which I know right now a bunch of aviation nerds are like, some people did a study that says that that won't affect stealth. It absolutely will from the side, and from the side especially. From head-on, it might still be low observability, but if you're coming in, if you're going to T-bone a J-20 in a dogfight, you're going to have no trouble spotting it. Aside from the fact that, again, these don't have super cruise capabilities, their WS-15 engine doesn't work, so they're using old Russian jet engines from the Su-35. These are not fifth-gen fighters, and they only have 12 of them. So you keep seeing these headlines all over the place about how scared we need to be of Russia and China's advanced fighters. These are token fleets with limited capabilities that at this point are nothing more than tech demonstrators.
Why, though, again, these guys, why don't they write the truth? What the hell?
I could tell you why, because if I wrote a story today, I wrote two stories in the past week about how these things aren't real legitimate threats, neither of them did particularly well in traffic.
Nobody wants to read the truth. So that's
People are not interested in finding out that there's nothing to worry about.
So if I'm going
to
make money,
they'd much rather know that the house is on fire.
So if I'm going to make money in journalism, I can't write the truth. If I want to write the truth, then I'm going to be out of a job.
Now, that's not true. Okay, for instance.
Sounded like it was true. Hold on. Here's an email for you. Mac, if you look at this story about the governor of Virginia, and I hate to take you back there, but I need to. This stupid jackass in 1983 or 4 in his yearbook, not only did he go to the party like that, but he agreed to have that picture in his yearbook of him. Now, the interesting part of the story is, they're not sure, and he's not saying which character he was. Was he the guy in the Ku Klux Klan costume, or is he the blackface guy? This story is so stupid. I'm laughing when I'm reading it, because he included a picture, and you're just like, the more you look at this, you're like, this guy's stupid, man. How do you ever get elected? But
I can tell you, because you don't get elected to a position like governor or president unless you're an asshole.
Well, let me tell you, these guys. So he goes on. So the story's so much worse. Not only did he actually go to the party dressed in one of those costumes, but then he doubles down on it and has it inserted, ha ha ha, into his yearbook page. This guy is the village idiot. Come on. Anyway, I was going to ask you, if you had to choose which costume to wear to that party, which one would you choose? But I know you won't answer it, because it's just a stupid question. Even in 1983 or 4, that was stupid.
Now, I want to be clear that I've done some stupid shit at parties.
Yes.
You know, I distinctly remember at one party mixing liquors to do a funnel instead of a beer.
Yeah,
this was in my active duty days. This is a different time. However, at no point have I ever been drunk enough to cheat on my wife or go in blackface. You know? These are inexcusable things that for some reason we tend to think we'll accept things like alcohol or youth as an excuse. I think that you'd be hard-pressed to find most people going to parties dressed like members of the Klan or in blackface, even in the 80s.
I'm with you. I lived through the 80s, and it wasn't something that I can remember seeing, because if you were living, let's just say you were in college in 1983 or 4, I had recently graduated. Okay, that meant you were, let's just say you were 20. So go back 10 years, 1973, you were 10 years old watching Watergate and the Vietnam War come to an end with all the racism that included, and which means since about the age of 7, you grew up acutely aware of what was going on racially in the country, okay, acutely. And if you lived in Virginia, there's no escaping it. So
absolutely.
Again, yeah, so no escaping it. All right, so that's interesting. Okay, the tinfoil hat theory of the week. U.S. is lying about being behind China and Russia in hypersonic technology.
So this one, this is probably about as tinfoil as you'll get from me. But here's my belief on this. So we're saying right now that we're probably 2 years behind. No, I take that back. We're probably more than 2 years behind Russia and China when it comes to hypersonic missile technology, because we claim we're still 2 years out from having a flight-testable platform. This is according to the Air Force General in Charge of Material Command.
Got it.
We're 2 years away from being able to flight test a platform, let alone actually field an operational missile, whereas China and Russia both claim they'll have hypersonic platforms in service within the next 2 years.
Okay.
My question here is, how in the hell did we end up 2 years behind or more these competitors when in 2004 we were flight testing hypersonic platforms? In 2004, I don't have the exact figures in front of me. I want to say it was something like Mach 5. We had a Mach 5, or at least hypersonic, which is greater than Mach 5, platform that we successfully tested in 04. We tested another one in 06, 07, 2011, as recently as 2017 with the Australians. In 2011, we had a hypersonic platform built by DARPA hit Mach 20 and maintain hypersonic speeds for more than 9 minutes with it transmitting data back to us. To give you a sense of how fast that is, this platform could have gone from New York to L.A. in 12 minutes.
That's okay. Look, I'm not an aviator like you, now that you're the editor of fightersweep.com. So, but that's fast, okay?
That's crazy fast. We're talking about – no, this is the value of a hypersonic weapon moving that fast is that it doesn't need to blow up. The kinetic energy transfer on impact moving at Mach 20 would vaporize most targets, right? So we already had, in 2011, DARPA successfully used, I think it was called the Falcon, already had a 9-minute-long hypersonic flight at, like, Mach 20. And now, fast forward to 2019, we're claiming that we've got nothing. We had a successful hypersonic missile test in Australia in 2017, like a year before all the hypersonic stories started breaking about China and Russia.
So what happened?
You know, I would recommend, I'd highly encourage, go and read the piece, because it'll give you actual dates and numbers as opposed to me just going off of memory. But suffice to say, we had at least 5 or 6 successful, just to varying degrees, hypersonic programs from 2000 forward. Right? So what the hell did happen? My theory is that we're further along in this hypersonic missile race than we're letting on, and we're happy to let the world and the American people think that we're behind for a couple of reasons.
Yeah, why?
The first one being the same reason why we lied about how far ahead Russia was during the Cold War, because it gives us carte blanche to spend a shit ton of money on developing these platforms. You know, we gave Lockheed Martin almost $1.5 billion last year. We awarded them these contracts that we hadn't intended on at the beginning of the year, you could argue, in order to accelerate our hypersonic programs, in order to close this capability gap that we've been talking about in the press all this time. What's interesting about that in particular, now this is where it gets really tinfoil for me, Lockheed Martin is also working on a different hypersonic program, which is the SR-72. It's supposed to be the successor to the SR-71, which, I mean, I bet you guys all know what that is. It's the Blackbird jet. It's the fastest jet we've ever built.
Can I ask you a question? Have you been to the National Air and Space Museum out by Dulles Airport?
I haven't. I really want to. I have not.
I went there last Saturday, and I'm not an aviation dork. Oh, my God. Oh, my absolute God. What an embarrassment you are. Like, how can you call yourself a fighter sweep guy and not have been to that thing? The SR-71 is in there. The Spatial Discovery is in there. The God darn, I almost used words I don't use. Enola Gay with the sight they use to drop.
That's awesome. That is awesome.
Yeah, you're like, oh my God, I gotta go to McDonald's. Cause they have one in there. Yeah, it's awesome. And then you run to McDonald's and you like you're doing all this anxiety eating, and then you go back out and you're like, oh, what else do I gotta see? So I'm telling you, bro, you're what an embarrassment, what a joke. All right, keep going.
All right, so the successor program to the SR-71 is really not much like the SR-71, but it's supposed to use scramjet technology to produce a hypersonic drone reconnaissance and strike platform. What's interesting about this is that, you know, that we're talking about like a drawing board program, right? We're, according to Lockheed and the DOD, we're testing scramjets on like real cars right now just to see if they'll fire. Even though we successfully tested a scramjet in 04.
Okay.
So last year, one of Lockheed's vice presidents gave a speech where he talked about the SR-72 in a very much past tense sort of way. He said, a couple of years ago, we never could have built this aircraft. But now, thanks to like new developments and new technology, we were able to build the engines so that it's got an extensive cooling system that's built into the platform itself. Now we have reliable firings. The aircraft itself is stable at hypersonic velocities under multiple firings. We've had successful flights. Talking about this thing as though it's an airplane that exists, not as though it's an airplane that's on the drawing board.
Ooh.
And it leads me to believe that maybe the SR-72 or other comparable tech demonstrator programs are further along than we're acknowledging. You know, the F-117 was flying operationally for about 10 years before the government admitted we had one, right? I could see something similar to that, whether it be a missile platform. You know, the Navy was developing the Sea Dragon secretly until the Chinese unveiled it last summer. We've got plenty of weapons programs that are shrouded in secrecy that certainly could already be hypersonic capable. We also have aircraft programs that are shrouded in secrecy that may be hypersonic capable. I would doubt manned aircraft, but maybe drones. So I think that a lot of this might genuinely be we're pretending to be behind, even though we were the pioneers of this technology, because it gives us the opportunity to invest heavily in it.
We're not that good that everybody has all our technology and secrets. How have we kept this a secret? Because I want to believe you because we tend not to fall, like they may be gaining on us, but we tend never to be behind anybody because of the R&D that we do in this country.
Absolutely. I'll give you a couple examples that are arguments in favor of this being possible, but I agree with you. Especially in this day and age, how on earth do you keep something like this a secret? Right. I can tell you that they built a massive new hangar on Area 51 last year.
Oh, my God. There you go. Just
now,
click,
when you hear Area 51, you think that it's crackpot stuff. But we are talking about a real military facility. It's a part of the Nellis Test Range. And it's an airstrip that they tested the U-2, the SR-71. Area 51, the Groom Lake facility, whatever you want to call it, has always been a test strip for advanced aircraft. That's what we've always used it for. I see no reason why we wouldn't now, you know. Conversely, there have been UFO sightings all over the country in recent years of a triangular-shaped aircraft flying high at high altitudes that people call UFOs. There's some really interesting pictures of it that you can find online that people like me tend to disregard because I'm like, yeah, it's a triangle in the sky. This would be really easy to Photoshop. But when you see enough of these sightings around from different parts of the country, part of me starts to wonder, that very well could be a tech demonstrator. It could be a prototype aircraft.
Whoa.
You know, the B-2 Spirit is still responsible for UFO sightings all over the country. I could totally say, probably not Little Green Men, if you really took a picture of something up there. It might just be an aircraft that we're not willing to acknowledge we have.
You know? So if you were a betting man, you would bet that we're not telling the truth about our own stealth technology.
Absolutely. I mean,
absolutely. You're going absolutely.
I would bet that 100%. But I would also be willing to bet that we've got at least a platform or two out there that we don't know a ton about publicly. The B-21 Raider, for instance, has been very publicly acknowledged. The program's been in development for years. It's supposed to enter service in 6 years, which means there ought to be B-21 Raiders doing flight tests right now. But according to the government, we're still doing aerodynamic testing on downscaled models. You know what I mean? Like, I don't believe that.
And you don't
but
go,
they are
you're
doing
not going
a very good job of keeping the B-21 under wraps, even though guys like me are looking for it. Yeah. So if I know to look for the B-21 and I don't know to look for, like, let's say a hypersonic flight demonstrator that's doing, you know, a drone that's doing flight tests over Nevada, it would be not that difficult to get me to brush it off as a crackpot UFO sighting, when in all reality it could be a flight test of something that we're not telling anybody we've got yet.
Oh, just in time at the end of your sentence.
Got it under the wire.
the art of the possible, shooting down ICBMs with jet fighters. How would that work?
So this is kind of a crazy idea, but I think it's an interesting one. The idea would be that we'd have to develop a new air-to-air missile platform that was capable of engaging an ICBM. These move very quickly. I know rockets look like they take off slowly, but they're moving faster than a bullet, faster than you can blink. These are very fast platforms. We're talking about Mach 3 by the time, you know, we've got lock on them, right?
Right.
So we would need to develop a new missile that would be able to do this. That might not be that expensive. And the idea would be that you'd have to have at least two F-35s in the vicinity of a launch, right?
Right.
Using those two F-35s, you could triangulate.
Wait, okay, so stop already.
Hit me.
They've got to be in the area of the
now
launch.
Now that's the problem, right? there's the rub. So if you've got two F-35s in the vicinity of a launch, they can triangulate where the weapon is and potentially engage it and shoot it down. Now, critics, I got to be honest with you, you picked it up faster than a lot of other folks. The first thing that you ask is, okay, well, then how the hell do you get F-35s in the area of a launch, right?
Nah.
It is technically possible, especially if we're talking about liquid-fueled rockets versus solid-fueled rockets. Let's say in North Korea, as an example, it takes a few hours to fuel a liquid-fuel rocket. So let's say they were potentially trying to launch a liquid-fueled ICBM from the North Korean or from the Korean Peninsula.
Okay, but why would we wait to let it launch when we could shoot it down and smoke it if we know that that's going on?
The idea would not be to use this F-35 Endeavor as your primary means of missile defense.
Oh,
it would be to have this as another one of the overlapping
layers.
Missile defense layers.
There's layers to the shit player. Tiramisu,
right? So right now we use THAAD. Which are ground-based. We've got one in South Korea, for instance, that's pissing a lot of people off.
Right.
It's a radar-based missile interceptor. Then we use the Aegis, which are sea-based missile interceptors. Our Aegis systems are mostly on the Arleigh Burke-class guided missile destroyers.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you're launching a nuke at us here in the United States, we have our very troubled and pretty shitty mid-course missile defense system that let's just hope we don't have to rely on. And so you've got these three layers of interwoven missile defense systems that would feasibly prevent an offensive launch from making landfall. None of these layers have 100% success rate, you know? So that's why it's so important that we layer them. So if the first one fails, the second one hopefully won't. And if it does as well, the third one hopefully won't.
Right.
These F-35s could potentially serve as a fourth layer, provided we were able to react fast enough, we were able to get them into the vicinity. But then things get even more complicated.
Whoa.
Let's say you
wait,
get two
F-35s. Whatever we'd launch off an air platform, can that chase down an ICBM?
Whatever we launch off an airport, like if we were to fire a missile from an F-35?
Yeah, if we
Not currently. We'd have to build a missile purpose-built to do it.
All right.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that's impossible. We're talking about an insane IR signature. We're talking about a huge radar cross-section.
Right.
And we're not talking about velocities that are unheard of.
Okay, and what are we talking about in terms of time of flight?
No, so this is where things get tough.
Oh, shit.
We'd have to have F-35s close enough to be within range of both their sensors and the missile platform at the time of launch in order to get it. Let's say within 250 miles, just for the sake of argument, since we're talking about a weapon system that doesn't exist, right? Let's say you got to be within 250 miles. It's a lot. There's more to it than just getting your F-35s to within 250 miles of this missile.
Right.
You got to find the missile.
Hard.
You've got to penetrate enemy airspace deep enough to access it, which is chances are good they're not going to park their ICBM that they're launching a nuke at us on the coastline.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be hidden in the woods in the mountains someplace. So once you locate it, then you've got to send aircraft to it. If you're using these two F-35s that are obviously going to be relying heavily on stealth, because even North Korea has anti-air defenses, even they have, you know, enemy fighters. These aircraft are only going to be able to carry what an F-35 can carry in their internal weapon systems. And if we're going to devote a number of those slots to anti-missile weapons, we're talking about having maybe 2 to 4 anti-aircraft weapons on board each of these F-35s tasked with this job. That means that at most, now, again, remember, F-35s aren't invisible. They're stealth.
Right.
So when North Korea deploys intercept fighters, when they start trying to launch surface-to-air missiles at us, the surface-to-air missiles probably aren't going to get locked. The enemy fighters feasibly could get visual contact with us and try to engage. The F-35s would have no trouble shooting down whatever. I think they're flying, what are they flying, J-15s, something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, crappy third- and fourth-gen fighters. They'd have no trouble shooting them down until they ran out of missiles in order to do so. So you'd actually have to send a huge number of F-35s into this fight in order to use their internal weapon stores to engage any enemy fighters to protect your missile attacking F-35s.
Right, right, right.
We're not talking about a simple undertaking.
It's a package, right? We launched the intercept fighters, right? We have to have naval assets, right, in the engagement area to support that. We got to have tankers up there.
For me, I would also have some Arsenal-style aircraft parked right outside.
What does Arsenal-style mean?
You take something like an F-A-18 Super Hornet, and you just stack it with as much ordnance as its pylons will support.
Right.
Now, that's not a radar or a low observability aircraft, so you don't necessarily want to fly it into a highly contested area. But what you can do is you send the F-35 in ahead. It identifies targets and transmits that targeting data back to the F-A-18 Super Hornet or the F-15 or whatever other aircraft you may have. It could be a B-52 Stratofortress. It launches the weapons and then uses the targeting data drawn from the F-35 to close with and destroy the target. We've already demonstrated the ability to do this. I think that it's feasibly the future of naval warfare in the near future is going to be us using Arsenal aircraft outside contested airspace to engage targets that our stealth aircraft are identifying. So you could definitely do that, but we're talking about a complicated situation. It's certainly not a solution to the missile threat.
We're talking about a complicated situation.
You know?
Yeah.
But it is potentially another layer we could put on, you know?
Yeah, let me just tell you, though, to try to penetrate, if a peer is setting up an ICBM shot, normally that's going to be pretty well locked down, or the window of the period of time, because let's just say it comes out of a cave. It's going to come out of the cave. It's going to go upright, and it's going.
If it's a solid fuel, absolutely. There's no way we'll be scrambling fighters in time, unless we have human to rely on.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, if you're talking about something that has to be fueled, it's feasible
that you see these. It's totally possible that you see them pull a missile out. If it's a liquid-fueled rocket, they start to fuel it. We launched Tomahawk cruise missiles from a ballistic missile submarine off the coast and rectify the situation before launch ever occurs. Or, as you've seen plenty of times in movies, you know, you send a group of special operations warfighters in there to capture the weapon, and you know, which, as crazy as that sounds, isn't that crazy.
Our SEAL team's already trained for that sort of thing. It sounds really crazy.
You know, but, you know, if we're worried about someone launching a nuke to California, crazy's in the cards, man.
Right. I've got an interesting email for you. Mac, I'm curious what Alex's thoughts are relative to all the trials going on in the special ops community. Your contention is they have lost their way as they grew so fast, and they did not have the mature operators that it took to handle that kind of responsibility, and thus you see the stupid shit that we're seeing in trials.
I think that that's a fair statement to make, but there are... The problems are further reaching and a bit deeper than that. Full admission here, over on NewsRep, you can find the work of Jack Murphy. He's our editor-in-chief. He's been on top of this stuff for years. He had been railing about issues with the SEAL teams and with other special operations teams. He himself, former Ranger and Green Beret, he had been railing about this environment and this culture, I mean, for at least 3 years now, and has been repeatedly accused of, you know, going against his own kind because he's a Green Beret, he's a former Ranger. How dare you shine a light into the, you know, the shadowy undergrowth of the special operations community. Now all of the stuff that he's been talking about is coming to fruition, and the mainstream media is acting like it's a revelation. You know, that said, Jack is a better guy to answer this question than I am. Would you
introduce us? Because
I would
look,
love to.
I've worked with those guys, and I've seen them, and I've seen the good and the bad and the ugly. And I will tell you, the American public is in for a pretty rude awakening if they start flipping rocks in that community. The email cites my, I mean, that's my, and again, I don't hate those guys.
No, absolutely not. I will admit, I think this is going to piss off. I'm friends with plenty of guys in the special operations community, and I apologize in advance. My experience as a guy who came from the conventional forces, right? I always say when it comes to this line of work, for instance, I work with conventional force guys, I work with special operations guys, and I work with spooks, right? Guys from the intel community. And when you give us an assignment, the way we tend to carry out those assignments, especially earlier in our writing careers, it's very indicative of where we came from in the force. Conventional guys, if you give me an assignment and you say that there's a fence line I need to work within, I will build and build and build until I'm whatever I built is higher than the fence line so I can see out and see what needs to get done. A special operations guy is just going to cut the fence. If you give him rules, he's going to break the rules. He's been being told he was special his entire career. He's not going to stop thinking it today. And then an intel guy is just going to go and find someone that they can manipulate to leave the fence
right.
and get the information for him, right? The special operations community inherently has a culture issue because they are a special operations community. Because they work, their job is to violate the law in foreign countries. You know, the CIA operates in a very similar capacity. You have to understand that when you spend 20 years living in this environment where laws are really just something or an inconvenience that interferes with your ability to do your job in 282 nations, and then in one nation you have to abide by them, I can see how culturally that could start to create some issues. That's not the real problem here, though.
But
the problem here is leadership.
Right. But again, so when you're talking about laws, you're not talking about, in theory, you're not talking about the law of land warfare. You're talking about the laws of some nation.
Well, you very feasibly could be, because you have to understand that, and I do not like armchair quarterbacking, especially as a non-combat veteran. I didn't see combat. So I am not going to nitpick the decisions someone makes in the fight, right? However, I've seen, like, historically now, time after time, accusations will surface, accusations here stateside of spousal abuse, you know, domestic violence, things like that. These things will surface and they're immediately squashed, you know, because there's this culture of looking out for your own. There's this culture of protecting the teams, you know, which is important. You have to have that in combat when you're alone and unafraid,
right?
You have to look
but
out
it's
for
no
one
different.
Another.
Let me just dispel this, okay? And this is what I want you to carry to your people. The lance corporal that walks down a street in Marja, right, or Fallujah or Ramadi with no ISR overhead and doesn't know what the fuck's in front of him, right, faces greater challenges than those guys do. If you've seen the packages that where they roll in with, the AC-130, the...
That's not fair. I don't agree with you, man.
The SIGINT drones, and they've been watching these targets for as long as they care to watch them, or they don't go. And they
You're
have,
absolutely
and
right.
They have people,
you,
and they have people...
They have
people,
a lot of tools.
Right, and they have people talking them and telling them where every fucking person is. And when you know this shit, and you watch the shit shows they get involved with, it's bullshit. It's bullshit, but they get a big pass because they're special operators. And then you have shit like in Lone Survivor that's, well, we should have shot those shepherds. We don't do that. We're Americans. We're the good guys. That's the shit the Nazis did. Flex cuff them and take them with you. Take
now,
their
this
stuff.
This is the problem, though,
take
is
their,
that the special
their,
operations community has been leaned on entirely too much.
Oh, that's
throughout the war.
You're making excuses for them. That's bullshit. That's, that is not an excuse to strangle.
It's not an excuse.
It's not an excuse. No, it's not. It's not an excuse to strangle people. It's not.
I didn't say that it was.
It's not an excuse to murder people.
I'm not justifying their behavior. What I'm saying is there's a reason we're where we are. And we're not going to change it unless we change what we're doing. As long as we let the leadership in these units protect their troops, even when they shouldn't be, sometimes you should be protected. As long as we let that go, as long as the fault never falls on anyone with something shiny on their collar, you know, like we're talking about, like in Niger, you know, the those Green Berets that were killed. How on earth are you going to blame the local command for that? You know, as long as people with collar weight don't get in any trouble, as long as we're protecting the guys that don't need to be protected, and as long as our operational tempo for the special operations community is as such that we're making these allowances in order for them to get their jobs done, things are not going to get better. We have to acknowledge what the different catalysts were that brought us here, and then we need to affect change to make anything different. It's not enough to just say this is unacceptable. You know, it's just like when we saw collisions in the Navy. It's not enough to just say be better. We, as a people, especially as the Defense Department's apparatus, we need to engage with and determine what led us to this crossroads.
But the same thing, the same things, I don't know if you read the articles that Jeff Zizulowitz wrote, and when somebody sent him that report that had not been leaked at all, and then he got his hands on it, and he wrote about the findings of the report that was done within 41 days of the Fitzgerald colliding. And again, what you saw, what you heard was this poor OOD, right?
Yeah,
this poor OOD, you know, and she's a victim of Navy justice. Bullshit. She was driving that ship at 20 knots through the first time it went through a shipping lane, right? That's a superhighway. Right? And it did not occur to her as the Lieutenant JG in the United States Navy that this is too fast. I'm not communicating with my CIC. I'm having ships pass close to us. I'm not even following the standard operating procedures on the bridge by going to waking the CO up, because we never do that shit. And he's in the rack. So is the XGO. I mean, this is a shit show. This is an absolute shit show. And you have people that did what they did when people murdered in Iraq. And I know this for a fact. People murdered in Iraq, and they got sent back to the United States to face court-martial. And what did the American media do? The Marine Corps is eating its own. What is going on here? We were not. If we wanted to eat our own, trust me, there's a lot of dishes we could have eaten over there. But we did not, because we know that's hard. We know that shit's hard. But they come back, and you read this shit, and you're like, and the first words she said after the collision that are in the report, I'm so fucked. If that is what you think when that happens,
there's a reason for it.
You're a total, you should never be in uniform, and I'm being really kind to her right now.
Here's my question.
Hold on, let me make one more point. Yet the article was about she has the lat and the longitude tattooed on her arm, right? So because she'll never forget it.
Congratulations.
Yes.
Another one here of the seven sailors exactly. who lost their family. The families of the seven sailors that lost loved ones. They won't forget either, you know? But this is what it really comes down to, is SOCOM, just like the Navy, you need to hold leadership accountable for the culture of your command, all right? Now, it's not always necessarily fair to blame the CEO for what the clerk does at the register. I understand that. But when you see systemic issues, that's when you need to start moving up the ladder. If one Navy SEAL committed some crimes, and then it turned out, you know, they tried to hide it at first, they weren't able to, and then he got caught. I would genuinely say 10% of any group's an asshole. You know, like 10% of the Marine Corps shouldn't have been there either.
Right.
It's a lot harder to make it to the Navy SEALs, but there's enough of them that 10% can still suck. I know some that do, right? So if we're willing to acknowledge that, then what we should be thinking is, okay, so what are the systems in place that we have to stop that 10% from committing war crimes? What systems do we have in place to self-regulate, to self-police? These Navy SEALs, as a Marine, as a Lance Corporal, if you were in the PX and your buddy, who's a Lance Corporal, walked into the PX wearing a plain white T-shirt and a pair of sweatpants with shower shoes on, and the first sergeant walks in, the first ass he's going to chew is that kid, and the second ass he's going to chew is yours. Because it's your responsibility to police your own, and all Marines are your own. This is a culture that we had in the Marine Corps that seems to be absent in the special operations community right now. They're more concerned with protecting their own, which makes perfect sense. I get it. I empathize with it. But to the point where they're actually hurting themselves. The special operations community needs to bounce back from this, and the only way they can do that is by injecting that honor, courage, and commitment back into their ethos in a way that has practical applications. Right now, they're all about the mission and whatever I got to do to make the mission. And because of that, I'm willing to break rules. And like you said, we're supposed to be the good guys. I firmly believe sometimes the national interest, national security means doing bad guy shit with the interest of the greater good. That's a different argument to have on a different day.
But when you do that
bad guy shit, it needs to be you need to be making a moral and ethical decision that you're weighing the implications of what you're doing.
Okay.
You're not just shooting a guy from a truck.
Right. And I agree. And there's an element of discipline in that. We only do it as a measured response, and then that decision is made by a leader, right, who takes full responsibility of it and can validate exactly why we do it. And that's important because that in that way you absolve the guy who pulls the trigger from the guilt and the nightmare that goes with that, because he knows that he did it for his country, and it was a lawful order, and they had to do it. We're so far from that, and in my opinion, the media apologizes. I heard I don't know if I should mention the case, but no, I will. It's got a guy named Ilario Pantano who came home. He shot two insurgents that were running away or were driving away in an area, right, that Marines had been wounded by, two military-age males in 2004. They have a snap BCP. His platoon stops them. They pull him out of the car. They got nothing. Gunshot residue on their hands, nothing. They rip the car apart. A sergeant radio operator and a corpsman rip it apart, nothing. So he says, go post yourselves as guardian angels. I'm going to have them search it. While they're searching it, supposedly one of them went for his rifle. Yep. He shot him he emptied a magazine of 28 rounds into him. He changed magazines and shot another 28 rounds into the two bodies. Total of 56 rounds, put a sign on the vehicle that said, no better friend, no worse enemy. And you read the statements of the corpsman, and the statement of the sergeant said, we didn't see them move. And that murder? And when I got home, this is now in the news, and I remember hearing Michael Savage just railing on the Marine Corps. Railing on the Marine Corps. And I just thought, holy shit, man. You can even change magazines and continue it and do whatever you know, and get away with it. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing. And so I don't know. Look, this is hard stuff. I get it, right? They need to be held to higher standards, not lower standards. And it starts with your behavior. And if
I agree. But I also think that it starts with holding the leadership accountable when these things not just happen, but are covered up,
let me give you an example. AFRICOM, right? Who investigated the incident inside AFRICOM?
AFRICOM.
General Waldhauser did. Well, let me tell you what. Let me tell you who's not going to get in trouble for that.
Yeah.
General Waldhauser or anybody in his chain of command of stuff they should have known, because these are basic questions in operations when you have soft guys out there. One, where are they getting supported from? Where are they getting medevac support from?
It's a really important point. It's really easy for us on the outside looking in to say, maybe not you and I because we've met enough of these guys, but it's easy, I think, for a lot of people to see Navy SEALs and Green Berets and Delta operators as like these, you know, these machines, these G.I. Joe guys. We're talking about dudes. We're talking about guys just like the guys that you know. You know, they've trained to an elite level. They've accomplished some incredible things. But they carry the same sort of baggage that all of us do with them when they go about their day. They're still worried about their electric bill. They're still worried about whether or not their wife is mad at them. They're still worried about getting their daughter into the gymnastics class that she wants to get into. These are real guys. And the reason why it's so important that we think of that is that you know in your heart of hearts that some real guys are bad people, right? Now, there's no test in BUDS. I mean, to be fair, you can be like peered out, you know, but there's no test in BUDS that says, no, this guy is eventually going to commit a war crime. It's really difficult to predict that. What you need to be able to do is you need to have the guys in your team, everybody's on the same page that this isn't what we do and this isn't who we are. When you establish a culture that's like that, and establishing a culture is not easy. It's not something that you can do with you know, a PowerPoint presentation. It's not something that you can do via MAR admin or naval letter. Establishing a culture takes time, it takes effort, and it takes being creative with where you assign personnel. You have to genuinely try to establish the type of culture that produces elite-level warfighters that make good decisions in the heat of battle. Because these are real guys with real problems. System's got to be bulletproof.
And I will tell you, that have to live with their shit after it's done. Done any research into the rate of suicide in the special operations community?
Yeah, it's extremely high, far higher than the average veteran community. I think it's something like 3 times higher. And none of that should surprise anybody in the least bit.
Well, and again, I would submit to you, it's not because of what they see.
I agree.
It's because of what they do. And that's
I agree to an extent. I think that a big part of that, I think that we as a whole tend to characterize veteran suicide as too much of a combat-oriented situation. Suicide is just as high among non-combat veterans as it is among combat veterans, which just goes to show that there's a lot at play here other than just what you did or what you saw.
No, again, it's a layer. But when you look
agreed.
Right, you look at the primary drivers of suicide are relationship and financial.
Absolutely.
And you see that. Now, why is the rate higher among special operators? Because their relationships? Because of the way they deploy?
Because it's impossible to maintain a relationship often as a special operator. Right. Absolutely.
Take an absolute beating. Financially, they tend to do pretty well. But their lives tend to become shit shows, completely oriented around their work. And then
what happens when you lose that title? What happens when you're no longer... I mean, it was very difficult for me as a Pogue. When I got out of the Marine Corps, I identified... I put everything I had into being good at being a Marine. You know, that was important to me. So then I was medically retired when I got hurt. When I got hurt, I wasn't a Marine anymore. And I, to be honest with you, that I think played a role in one of the bigger periods of just really being down in the dumps of my life. I had five surgeries in a row. I was always on crutches. I'm not a Marine anymore. I'm getting fatter. That was really, really hard for me to cope with. I can't imagine if my entire life, my career has been built on the idea that I am an elite special operations warfighter. I'm a Delta operator. I'm a SEAL Team 6 member. SEAL Team 3, for that matter. You know, you're a Navy SEAL, and then you get out, and you're just not anymore. Now you got to find a job, you know, and it turns out the jobs that you're particularly well-suited for are either contracting or starting, to be honest, at the bottom of the barrel in a lot of industries. And so you go from being one of the most respected and renowned warfighters on the planet through title alone, if nothing else, to the guy installing somebody's cable. I can absolutely understand why that would lead to depression.
They need post-traumatic winning, bro. I'm telling you.
They do.
Because,
I agree.
Because those,
I love this post-traumatic winning program.
Those connections, you don't have to lose. That what you did, just because you're no longer doing it, doesn't mean that you aren't those things anymore. But life moves on, and you got to make peace with it.
Absolutely. Right? And I don't want to paint Navy SEALs or any other special operations veteran as like someone who has trouble coping with this because they're emotionally weak.
Well, but
they're certainly not. They're obviously very tough. But these are human issues. There's nothing weak about struggling with that transition from going from what is the warrior class. If you're a Navy SEAL or a Green Beret, you saw more combat than conventional troops did, almost certainly. You have spent your entire life built on the idea, you know, when you go out on a patrol as a conventional forces infantry Marine, you don't know for certain necessarily more often than not that you're going to be in an engagement during that patrol.
Right.
More often than not, as an Army Ranger, when you go out, it is for an engagement. You're either going to go and get somebody and hope there are no shots fired, or you know for a fact that there's going to be shots fired. Chances are shots are already being fired while you're on your way. These guys live and die on the idea of fighting, of winning, of killing. I'm not saying that it brainwashes you or indoctrinates you, but what I am saying is that when you come back to the regular old world that's boring and just full of drama and bullshit, it's going to be difficult. It's difficult for your average Joe Marine like me to leave the barracks and move into my regular old house and then be an HR guy. If it's tough for me, it's certainly going to be tough for somebody who's been operating at that level and who has had so much responsibility thrust on them by the nation. So much trust put in them by the nation. And then you get to the other side and no one will award you responsibility or trust.
Right.
You'll get yellow ribbon admiration, but it's neither here nor there.
Right.
And you still got to pay your bills.
Who needs that?
You know?
Again, that's the satire that is thank you for your service.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's why I think one of the worst things that this country has ever jumped on the bandwagon for is the Yellow Ribbon Initiative. I don't mean Yellow Ribbon programs.
No, you know, but again,
but the idea that I can slap a magnet on the trunk of my car and I've supported the war effort. I don't need you to support the war effort, and I don't need you to thank me, but I need you to vote for politicians that'll fund the VA properly. I need you to make sure we hold our veteran and our military institutions accountable. The Yellow Ribbon doesn't do that.
Yeah, but again, I understand the sentiment, and again, for the people that do it, you know, God bless you for doing it, because they're doing what they think they ought to be doing.
I appreciate
right?
the sentiment, but right. But I do not like the diffuse responsibility we as a people tend to maintain when it comes to the wars that we're involved in. You know, I mean, write a story on any major outlet right now about a war in Afghanistan, and if it's not about Trump wanting to pull out, nobody will click on it.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And there's a reason why you don't see a ton of stories out there about combat operations in Afghanistan, and it's because even though Americans are fighting and dying there, the American public is overwhelmingly disinterested.
Right, you know. Right. My guest, we've kept him overtime by a long shot, is Alex Hollings. And, all right, anything else that you want to get off your chest? I think that if the – hold on, let me read this email. Mac, I remember you reading an article recently that talked about the Deputy Secretary of the Navy having done some sort of inquiry into the status of the special operations community in the Navy and whether it had structural issues. He concluded that they did not. When you have those kind of people in charge, then you get what you get.
Well, you know, in their defense, because I want to be clear that I don't mean to bag on the special operations community.
You're not bagging on the special operations community one bit. But the truth is important. And look, they know if you talk to them, they know they have these issues. Trust me.
Absolutely.
Know they have these issues.
You know, I hear from them every day. And honestly, a lot of the special operations veterans that I know, they're pissed off that the good name that they worked so hard to cultivate is being dragged through the mud by – and to be fair, we are talking about individuals. My problem, to be perfectly frank, in the moment are the individuals and their horrendous actions, of course.
Right.
But from a national security standpoint, my problem is the culture, the command climate that's allowing these things to go unpunished, that's allowing these things to
work. And when it goes wrong, are they held accountable? Look what happened in Paris Island. In Paris Island, a gunny who was still under investigation was allowed to go back to work. The lieutenant colonel, who was the battalion commander, and the company commander, I haven't even heard him mentioned in it. But the lieutenant colonel, and this goes back to down there is the Marine Corps kind of get ahead for other MOSs. So you're a judge advocate, and you've never been in command of shit. Well, we'll send you to the drill field, and you can do it down there. And that way we'll prepare you for some other greater job. Right? We didn't put no shit commanders down there who've been in command because Disneyland is a really important little fantasy that we create down there, and we better have experienced commanders. No, we put novices down there. Okay, so that novice has a gunny come back who's under investigation for hazing, unresolved, so he's not supposed to be around Marines. Okay, he's supposed to be over in supply or in public affairs doing some other bullshit. The gunny got recommended 7 years as his court-martial. The court gave him 10. He's got a wife and four daughters. What do you think the lieutenant colonel got? He got a $2,000 fine. And they're going to do a BOI to say whether he should retire as lieutenant colonel. Haven't seen shit about that. That's officer justice. General Waldhauser was allowed to investigate himself. And I will tell you this, there's a lot of senior officers in AFRICOM that were there at the time who were really happy that Secretary Mattis stepped down because he made the punitive letter of reprimand against the captain down there go away, and he was looking for the senior officers that were responsible, and Waldhauser's one of them.
I want to take a minute before I end up off the air here. I know the people who listen to this show know who you are, all right? In case there's young Marines out there listening, just in case there's guys it's the first time you've ever listened, the reason why what Mac's saying is so important is because he's not some enlisted asshole. He's not some sergeant like me lamenting the way that the officers are being treated in these situations. He's an officer. He's an infantry officer. He's commanded troops saying that the officers in charge of these units need to be held accountable for their actions and for the cultures that they cultivate within their commands. That means something. When you're hearing it from Mac, the guy who feasibly would be in that guy's shoes, were he in command of that unit at that time. When you hear it from Mac, we're talking about someone talking we're not talking about me as a sergeant pissed off about officers getting more medals. We're talking about someone talking peers.
Right.
When you're talking about your peers in the officer corps and saying they need to be held accountable, that carries a significant weight that I want to make sure you get credit for.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. The no, enlisted guys say always ask me, like, were you prior enlisted? And I say,
it's true. You do. You come off as an enlisted guy, in my opinion.
I tell him, no, I'm just really fucking cool.
I'm just rad, man.
But let me tell you, you want to make sure things go right at Paris Island and MCRD. Throw that lieutenant colonel right in the brig for 90 days. Right, 90 days. That's all. Throw a sergeant major in there. Throw the company commander and the first sergeant. You're all going to the brig for 90 days. Thanks, boys. We'll talk to you later. right? You want to make sure people make sure they pay attention in operations briefs when we're briefing, you know, medevac timelines and we're briefing, right, air support timelines for soft guys going out to accompany people on key leader engagements, right? Send one of those son of a bitches to the brig for 90 days, right? And watch everybody else go, oh, shit, right? But the OOD, right, for the Fitzgerald, right?
Yeah,
got a non-punitive, got a punitive letter of reprimand or some shit like that, okay? She killed seven people. The one in the CIC, initially they were not even going to court-martial her. And she didn't, they're transiting a trap, and she did not even speak to the officer of the deck because they didn't like each other. Like, I don't give a fuck if you like each other. This is pro shit, okay? You have a job to do. And, oh, well, all of our systems weren't working. That's no excuse. I operated combat operation centers where all of our shit weren't working because the dust blows the satellite dishes. And when the satellite dishes can't sync up, guess what you have? World War II, COC. So what
exactly.
Do? You get on the fucking radio, and you start filling out yellow canaries, and then you do it the exact same way, but you're not absolved of your responsibility. And it's just, it drives, as you can't tell,
honestly,
it drives me fucking crazy.
My experience working at the COC is that it's, comms are never up.
Right, right. So don't, and then the Navy's like, oh, we had degraded radar. Look, all I know is this. For a couple hundred years, we've been rolling around the world in ships, not driving into people, okay? Especially things that are bigger than shit and lit up like trains, right? So it's not, it can't be that hard. And if your systems are degraded, what do? Maybe we should get the boss up, right? Maybe we should double the lookouts because our ship's not working. All those things you could have done and slowed the goddamn ship down, right? Blah, 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 and we're not doing it. And the worst part is people get killed. People get killed. So, anyway. Yeah, send them to jail. Send them to jail. Tighten a lot of shit up there. All right, what's next? What's next on the horizon? What are you writing today?
I've got a couple of stories developing today. I've got a story about the Navy's got their Sea Hunter drone, which is like a 130-foot drone ship. It's a ghost ship. It just successfully made a voyage from San Diego to Hawaii on its own. And I think that this is something we're going to see changing the Navy quite a bit. Are these unmanned vessels that are capable of conducting some limited level of combat operations without having troops on ship whatsoever. And I think that that's a good thing for us because sailors are expensive, and when they die, it's a real bummer.
Right.
So the more we can have automated ships out there, I think the better. You're also going to see what else. I got a couple other crazy things going on.
Hey,
I
you
got
know, just
some
so you
INF
know,
stuff. I've
that
got,
is,
oh, man,
that
this
is
a big
that,
week.
That is the wave of the future to include, you know, you're going to see drones. You're going to see an F-35 version, in my opinion, made with that is that will not have a pilot in it. It will not have to have all the systems that are needed when you put a human being in there, which will make it a lot cheaper. And that is the future of aviation. And
now, I'm gonna not go down this tunnel because I do have to get to work. But I think what you're gonna see are manned F-35s accompanied by unmanned F-16s,
right.
F-15s, FA-18s. The Loyal Wingman program has already successfully made F-16s fly autonomously. I don't know why we're not leaning more heavily into this idea, but I think you'll see like network capability 5th-gen, even 6th-gen fighters in the future, serving as the hub where we're going to have 4th-gen fighters, you know, serving as a defensive and offensive bubble around our really expensive planes. I think that's the future. And same methodology with the Navy. I totally agree. You know.
All right, Alex Hollings. There you go. In size 6 font. All right. That's how fast he talks. Thanks for the visit, man. I appreciate it.
Hey, I'm always happy to be here. Thanks for letting me move to Tuesday.
No. Hey, look, you move anywhere you want to. You have fans here, so they love you.
I appreciate it. I do. Every time I get a message about showing up on All Marine Radio, it makes my day. So thank you to all you guys that listen. It really does mean the world to me.
All right. Thanks, Alex. Have a good one.
Say
hi to your mom. Tell her welcome to Georgia.
I'll tell my wife you said hi, but not my mom.
All right, later. That is Alex Hollings here on an extended version. Mike is tied up a little bit today, so we were able to go along with Alex, which is an interesting conversation about not only journalism, but journalism and the soft community. So don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it. the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it. The McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the ReadBoard page at allmarineradio.com.